Cabo is proud to present one of the greatest jazz films ever made, Round Midnight. Join us Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater for this 1986 American-French film that captured the Paris jazz scene of the 1950s. Watch jazz legend Dexter Gordon deliver an Oscar-nominated performance. Round Midnight, the Clinton Street Theater, Thursday, December 12th at 7 p.m., 2522 Southeast Clinton.
In conjunction with KBOO's presentation of Round Midnight at the Clinton Street Theater, tune in Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, when KBOO Jazz host Rita Rega talks with bassist Chuck Israels about his experiences in the Paris jazz scene in the 1950s, playing with pianist Bud Powell, the real-life inspiration for the film. That's Wednesday afternoon, December 11th, between noon and 2 p.m. on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
To the Recovery Zone 11 to noon this Wednesday to find out how our food choices may be affecting the environment, our health, and our relationships with one another.
If we really are serious about wanting to have peace on this planet, we have to look at the ramifications of our food choices. We're not some kind of species that is fundamentally flawed. We're always going to have domination and war and so forth. We're born into a culture essentially with an obsolete food orientation. And the beauty of the message is that we absolutely can transform our culture.
Learn more from Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, on the Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland this Wednesday, November 27th from 11 to noon. Your turkey day could well never be the same.
And you're tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming right up on Political Perspectives, Teresa Mitchell interviews Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. At 10 o'clock on Flashpoints, Gareth Porter analyzes the recent Iran nuclear agreement. Also in Santa Rosa, California, young Latinos continue to protest recent police killing of 13-year-old Andy Lopez. Immigrants' rights activists protest ongoing massive deportations. And Bill Means of the American Indian Movement talks about the battle to decolonize the Washington Redskins. Then at 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, author Will Tuttle discusses the World Peace Diet and how a shift in food choices, we just heard about this, how food choices could help the environment, increase food for the world's poor, and reconnect people with the innate feelings of compassion. And I've got to thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Thanks a lot. We're happy you're out there listening. And if you'd like to make a contribution, you can go to kboo.fm and click on Donate Today.
Good morning, it's 9:04, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell, and today I'm here for Political Perspectives and a terrific interview coming up about angry white men. Angry white men, and I'm going to talk with Dr. Michael Kimmel. He is a distinguished professor of sociology. He is the distinguished professor of sociology and gender studies at Stony Brook University in New York. He is also the executive director at the Center for the Study of Men and Masculinities. He is author or editor of more than 20 books, including Manhood in America, The Gendered Society, The History of Men, and Guy Land. And if the phone magic is working, we have Dr. Michael Kimmel right now. Welcome to KBOO Community Radio, Dr. Kimmel.
Hi, nice to be with you, Teresa.
I'm glad that you could join us. I liked your book well enough to spill coffee on it, and that's a compliment. I wouldn't spill coffee on Murray and Herrnstein. A lot of your new book seems to be about entitlement, privilege, and what you call aggrieved entitlement, and it is something that I often think about when I listen to, Angry White Man Radio, and you've done a great deal of analysis of that. So please talk for a moment about entitlement. If there's only 17 women in the Senate, why do these guys feel aggrieved, victimized?
Well, there is something to that. I mean, you know, when you're used to looking out at the world and seeing 100% of all the boards of every company being men or sitting around the table, or 100% of all legislators and the local, national, regional, global level being men, when there's suddenly 85%, you think, oh my God, the world's coming to an end.
It's going down the tubes.
The end of men. I first started thinking about this book and that theme of aggrieved entitlement when I was on a TV talk show opposite four, you could call them angry white men who believed that they were the victims of reverse discrimination in the workplace and that they were qualified for jobs and promotions and they didn't get them. And the title of the show, of this particular episode, was a quote from one of these men. And the quote was, "A black woman stole my job." So these guys all told their story about how they were qualified for this job. And then it was my turn to speak. And I just said, I have one question for you guys about the title of the show, "A Black Woman Stole My Job." Actually, it's a question about one word in the title. I want to know about the word "my." Where did you get the idea it was your job? Why isn't the title of the show, "A Black Woman Got the Job," or "A Black Woman Got a Job"? Because without confronting men's sense of entitlement, we'll never understand what lies underneath men's anger, their feeling that their anger is righteous because they were entitled to those jobs and they're not going to get them. Look, their fathers were entitled to those jobs and they did get them. Their grandfathers were entitled to those jobs and they did get them. So these guys are angry because they spent their whole lives sort of basically planning to walk into the positions that they thought were theirs. And suddenly they've disappeared.
And it really is. I mean, when I first looked at it, I thought, well, there's not much to it. It's like, they were used to having it all. Now they don't. Now they're mad. But wait a minute. There is a lot more to it. And you really get into it. And this is the real service of your book, Angry White Men by Michael Kimmel. It's that question of why? as I was saying, it seems like a pretty good run since the height of the Inquisition was a few hundred years. But it doesn't work that way. It's like if you get your cupcake every day, when the cupcake goes away, you don't say, gosh, that was great for the years that I got my cupcake every day. That's not what you normally, I guess it's just human nature, is say, what happened to my cupcake? What's wrong with me? What's wrong with you?
If you're a runner and you run with the wind at your back, you don't know that you're being pushed along. You just think, this is how I run. I'm really good at this. And when you turn around, you go, whoa, this is unfair. So exactly. I mean, when you're used to something, you become accustomed to it. It feels like a level playing field. I mean, the reality, of course, is that, I mean, the paradox, of course, is this. Outside of hereditary aristocracy, American white men are among the most privileged people on the face of the earth. I mean, most people on the face of the earth are living on $2 a day. So, it doesn't take much to be in the top 10% globally. but we don't feel privileged. We don't feel powerful. And in that feeling, in that mismatch between our actual position and the feelings that we have is very exploitable, I believe, by elites who want to massage or propel that anger in particular directions.
Now that is one of the really useful things I found about this book. There's many angles I want to go into, but you reveal the technique of Rush Limbaugh and other demagogues in converting confusion and grief about change into anger. And could you explain how that's done?
Well, that was I sort of learned this from my friend and colleague Jackson Katz, who had listened to Rush Limbaugh a lot, and so I started listening to him. And Jackson has this little has a piece in the Huffington Post where he describes listening to a particular episode where a man calls Rush and says to him, I'm really, really upset, Rush. I'm really sad. I lost my job. It got outsourced, and we're living hand to mouth. We don't have any savings. We don't have any health care, and I'm really upset. And Limbaugh says to him, you don't sound upset. You don't sound sad. You sound angry. And then Limbaugh gives him a list of reasons why he should be angry, therefore, thereby kind of taking his feelings of being of anguish and despair and trying to transform it into anger. The guy didn't call up angry, but he hung up angry.
He had been, and anger is the one emotion that's okay to have as a male and still be manly.
And you know what? I actually think that a lot of American men have a good, there's good reason to be angry. And if you were to see your position, your situation, a lot of the men that I talk to, lower middle class guys, if they were to see their situation in class terms, they would end up, you know, Tom Joad. They'd end up Bruce Springsteen. That is to say, they'd end up on the left. But when they see their position through racial terms, it's those immigrants, it's those people of color, it's the women, it's whatever, it's LGBT, whatever has caused this, then they turn to the right. So their anger is manipulable and could go either way. You know, populism is not a theory, it's an emotion. And it's that emotion of being aggrieved. They have done something to us, we're the victim of them. And once, if you, and there are a lot of different thems we could identify. There's predatory lenders and big banks and corporations, or there's immigrants and blacks and women.
Huh. So, yeah, and another question I want to ask you is, you know, why is this particularly happening now? I mean, this is, I suppose men's fortunes have risen and fallen, but male entitlement's been going on for a long time. I mean, you know, there's Aquinas saying that woman is defective and misbegotten for the active force in the male seed tends to the production of a perfect likeness, meaning of God, in the masculine sex. And Jerome said, woman is a tool of Satan and a pathway to hell. And, you know, and so the I'm contrasting with women. I mean, this is about angry white men, so we have race to talk about as well, but... well, I mean, why is it happening? Why are people so mad now? Why are white guys so mad now?
Okay, this is a good question. I think that the rapidity of change in our society, let's be quite clear, women and men, there has never been in our society a greater amount of gender, sexual, and racial equality. Now, let me be clear. I am not saying we're there by any means. We have a long way to go, but it's incontestable that women and men are more equal than they ever have been. It's incontestable that LGBT people are more equal than they have ever been. It's incontestable that people of color are more equal than they've ever been. Now, given that, there's miles to go before we sleep. We understand that. So the rapidity of change has been so dramatic that a lot of men, and a lot of white men, and a lot of straight white men are kind of left reeling like, whoa, what just hit us? You know, we grew up thinking these were going to be the positions we were going to go into. We thought that this is what, you know, that the office was supposed to look like the set of Mad Men with, you know, all the men have the offices around the windows.
That's an interesting frame, isn't it?
Mad Men. In the middle and we get our pick.
Yeah.
You know, that was what the workplace was supposed to look like. It looked like that for my daddy. It looked like that for my grandpa. So that's what it should look like for us. And now, acting like Don Draper could get you put in jail for sexual harassment.
Well, and rightly so, and it's a funny thing.
You bet, rightly so. but what I'm saying is that the change, the pace of change, has been so dramatically fast that a lot of guys are kind of left swimming, like spinning, like, whoa, what happened? And that's why I think there's this sort of this emergence of this kind of outrage. That coupled, of course, with dramatic economic transformation.
Well, and I've been laughing a lot, but this is serious business because this has resulted in a great deal of violence. We're talking about causes of rape. We're talking about the violence against black men, for example, by white cops who, in my opinion, are simply acting out the subconscious fears of white male voters. I'm impressed. I'm sorry?
You know, I think that, you know, the... When you put on a blue uniform, you don't stop being white or black, and you don't stop seeing the world in those racial terms. And of course, you know, there's a lot of evidence of, you know, and we're struggling with this here in New York about questions about racial profiling. You know, we are constantly having national conversations about this with, you know, with Trayvon Martin, for example, and other cases like that. It seems to me that we are constantly being forced to look at the ways in which we respond to this dramatic change, and we are bringing along baggage of stereotypes that are long outdated.
You know, and I'm talking with Michael Kimmel. You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. The name of the book is Angry White Men, and I'm impressed, Dr. Kimmel, that you are able to go directly to groups of angry men and ask them questions, even though you, as a Jew, are a target of their rage. I can't imagine having that degree of courage and restraint. I mean, I'm a 55-year-old tranny, and I got to work with the public every day, but, you know, I kind of tone it down. There are some questions that I don't particularly feel like asking unless I'm already in a fight. The revelations that you obtain are really very, very useful. And I wonder what would be necessary to undo that that feeling of being aggrieved, but there's so much more analysis to get into before we even get to that point. So maybe I'll withdraw that question for now, and I want to talk about you analyze the mass shootings by white males.
Okay, and I would like to say something just very quickly about my I appreciate that that you think that it was sort of courageous. I think it was sort of stupid at times,
that's part of
it. The thing that was important for me, I had rules about how I would talk to some of these guys. You know, I never went to meetings or met them in the evening or at their homes or anything like that, or more than one at a time. When I would go up to their literature tables, this is how I met most of the guys I talked to. I would go up to the literature tables at gun shows. There's always a table with pamphlets and leaflets outside.
See, that's what I can't imagine.
And I would just sort of, you know, and I would just sort of say, is this your leaflet? Is this your pamphlet? You know, can you tell me about this? And, you know, I opened my mouth and they know that, you know, I'm not from around here, you know. And so I'm not going to try to pretend to be one of them. I mean, except that would be kind of stupid. So what I decided to do instead is say, look, you know, I'm your worst nightmare. I'm a New York Jewish liberal sociologist. But here's what I want to do. You know, there's no way we're going to convince each other that we're right. But here's what I want to do. I want to understand the world that you live in, because obviously, given who I am, I can't understand it. I can't understand how you see the world. And what I found was that the major complaint of a large number of men on the extreme right is that no one's listening to them, that they're the forgotten Americans, that they are the ones who built America. They're the ones who drive its railroads, who built the bridges, who made the cars, who made the steel, and they're completely forgotten. And so I said, look, I'm not going to convince you. You're not going to convince me, but I will listen. That's my job. My job is to try to understand the world as you see it. So let's not argue. Let me try and understand how you see things.
They sure didn't build the White House.
A lot of them didn't want to talk to me, and some of them did. So
well,
I did talk to about 40 or so guys who were willing to talk to me, and I got an idea about what their position is. You know, these are not, now I'm talking about guys on the extreme right, you know, white supremacists and,
right,
you know, separatists. I'm not talking about mass murderers or mass shooters or anything like that. This isn't Jared Lochner or anybody, or, you know, Adam Lanza or anybody like that. These are guys who really believe in the American dream. They believe in America. They hate the government, obviously, but they love America, the idea of America. And so in that sense, they're real true believers, and I feel like we were able to connect a little bit on that idea because, you know, I'm a baby boomer who was raised in the era of reading Profiles in Courage in sixth grade, and I was a Kennedy boy, and I believed that I believed in the Camelot ideal, and, you know, that kind of sucked me in also. And so I felt like, well, this idea of believing in the idea of America is a place where we actually have some common ground. Where has America betrayed us?
I also find that some of these ideas are, you know, frankly, delusions, and some of these delusions seem to be a basis, you know, just basis on, based on what I'm reading in your book and what I find on the angry male websites or the men's rights activist websites is what I mean to say. For example, I pulled up one just this morning just to see what was on it, and it was talking about New York stop and frisks. And just quoting a part of what I found, a man wrote, "New York stop and frisks are a good recent issue to look at. The media will usually state that about 88% of those stopped are non-white, varies by year, but fail to mention that 93.1% of those stopped are male. In fact, assuming those numbers hold true, non-white women are less likely to be stopped than white men." And so what he's where he's going, of course, is saying that men are being picked on. And, of course, the Department of Justice just came out with a 1980 to 2008 study that showed 90% of violent crime was being caused by men. And so this writer is willfully ignoring a really, I mean, this is not an obscure context.
Right. There's two things going on here, and I think that they're both important. You know, first of all, as a social scientist, I have to say, there are two variables that predict about 90-something percent of all the violence in America, and those variables are age and gender. So young men, that is to say between the ages of 15 and 35, commit most acts of violence, I mean, like well over 90%. So given that, I mean, if you find something that predicts about 90% of all cases, you're, as a social scientist, you've hit the gold standard. I mean, you have it. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, he's arguing that there's gender profiling as well as racial profiling.
Yeah.
And that is a kind of interesting phenomenon, because when these guys talk about men's rights, they almost never talk about black men. They almost never talk about gay men. They almost never talk about men of color. They never, you know, their interest is really in straight white men, mostly married or actually more often divorced.
And you were saying they want people to listen to them?
Yes. Well, I agree. I think there is some amount. This is a place where I would, you know, agree with some of this idea. There is, of course, gender profiling that does make a certain amount of sense to the police, from the police side, because they say, well, the likelihood of committing crimes is much higher among men than it is among women. Now, the question for us is it true, given that the significant 88% of crime is committed by men of color? That is clearly not true. So we now have to talk about it as empirical questions. Is it reasonable? I mean, not politically reasonable. There could be a political debate about this. But is it reasonable empirically, according to the data, to profile males as potential violent criminals?
And
the answer to that, empirically, not politically, is yes. Is it reasonable, empirically, that is by the data, to profile men of color as potential violent criminals? The answer to that is no.
Well, and right. But you're not actually down on men. You're just citing the stats there, and you also cite a study of primates that shows that testosterone does not cause hierarchic violence, but rather that it exacerbates it. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I just want to finish this one. This
okay,
one.
Sure.
So I believe that in my book, what I try to do is I try to be really empathic and compassionate toward the men who are expressing all of this anger, knowing A, that some of it's been manipulated, knowing B, that they really are feeling real feelings, and it does us no good politically ever to say to people, "Well, your feelings are wrong." I mean, your feelings are your feelings. What you have to do is they may be real, but they may not be true. That is, they may not be you may not have the right analysis of your situation, but you are certainly having these feelings, and they're real, and we have to pay attention to them.
I think there's something powerful in that.
Yeah, I tried to be very compassionate, and I think a good reader. Now, I grant you that most of the readers on most of the non-readers on these websites that will denounce me will, of course, not exactly have read the book, nor will they be interested in seeing any amount of empathy or compassion that I might have. But I think a discerning reader would see that. So let me tell you about this testosterone study, because
yeah.
It's a study by because it's a really interesting study. Very often, what happens when we talk about men and violence is we talk about biology. That's our constant reference. Well, men have testosterone. Women have almost, you know, so little testosterone. We have so much testosterone. And, of course, as you know, if you were to inject yourself with testosterone, your aggression levels would go up, your sexual energy would go up, et cetera, et cetera. And so we all know that. And so we have this kind of facile idea that testosterone causes aggression. And the studies of this are much more complex than that. For example, what we also know is aggression causes testosterone, which is to say, if I take two men and match them up in a competition of some kind, and I match their testosterone levels, that is to say, they have the same level, the one who wins the competition, his testosterone level will go up, and the one who loses, his testosterone level will go down. Now, that's not that testosterone is the cause of the aggression. It's actually the effect. So that's a pretty interesting
thing. Sort of a psycho-neuro-endocrinological reward system?
Yeah, well, yes, of course, because, you know, you get endorphins, you get a little testosterone boost. You know, winning is good and you feel good. But let me tell you the other story, because this is the one that my students absolutely baffles my students when I first explain it to them. There's a neuroprimatologist at Stanford, a MacArthur winner named Robert Sapolsky, and he's brilliant. He has done this. He's the one who's done the classic monkey studies, where you take five monkeys and you put them in a cage, and they immediately sort themselves into a hierarchy, and they do so, actually, by one of the features is their testosterone level. So monkey A beats up monkey B, who beats up monkey C, who beats up monkey D, who beats up monkey E. And they have a nice hierarchy, and monkey A's testosterone level is the highest, et cetera. So here's the experiment. You take out the middle monkey, monkey C, and you give him an injection of testosterone that sends his testosterone level soaring beyond that of the top monkey, and then you put him back in the cage. What happens? Now, my students all say he immediately becomes the top monkey. That's the standard idea, because he now has the most testosterone, he will beat up everybody else. That's not what happens at all. What happens is he still avoids monkeys A and B, but he beats the crap out of D and E. He makes their life a living hell. He just constantly goes after them. So what does Sapolsky conclude from this? He concludes that testosterone doesn't cause the aggression. He concludes instead that testosterone enables the aggression, but the target of the aggression has to already be perceived as legitimate. Now, that's the key. So that when you get a big dose of testosterone and your aggression soars, you don't go after your boss.
Yeah, it's the social hierarchy. I mean, that really exposes
right.
that. I think that's
you
fascinating.
You don't go after somebody who's above you on the social hierarchy, but you definitely look down below you and say, oh, I can beat them up. I can take care of them. So you have to perceive your target as legitimate. That makes you understand how testosterone is not the driving force, for example, of men's violence against women. It's the fact that men see women as a legitimate target of their violence, or that these men who do it see these women as a legitimate target. They don't beat up their boss. They don't beat up their coworkers. They beat up their wives and girlfriends.
And I guess the other corollary could be that monkeys invented fascism. Well, the time is 9:28, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is an interview with Michael Kimmel, author of Angry White Men, American Masculinity, and the End of an Era. And now we have the phone lines open and available to you, and you can call in if you have comments or questions for Michael Kimmel. And the number to call is 503-231-8187. Let me give that to you again, 503 area code 231-8187. This is KBOO Community Radio. That's why I can do an almost one-hour interview without commercial interruptions, and it's all up to you, and we are supported by anyone who cares, and not by the government, not by corporations. And if you're listening on KBOO.fm, why don't you just mosey over to the tip jar and give us a few bucks, because that's how we keep rolling. That and our semi-annual pledge drives. I guess they're more than semi-annual, but some of our pledge drives are kind of semi. But anyway, once again, the name of the book is Angry White Men, and that's the topic, and it's American Masculinity at the End of an Era by Dr. Michael Kimmel. And I was talking about history of white supremacy in the U.S. and history of supremacy over women. Woodrow Wilson, many people don't know this, resegregated the White House and the cabinet. And he liked to tell racist jokes. His favorite movie was Birth of a Nation. The National Association for Advancement of Colored People publicly denounced the movie's blatant appeals to racial prejudice even then, but the president organized a private screening of his friend's film in the White House for members of his cabinet and their families. Just want to throw out a little history for you there. And now, as Dr. Kimmel was saying, things are changing rapidly, and there seems to be quite the reaction. And some, I would say that some of this reaction is rather delusional, but Dr. Kimmel is going further than that. He's looking at what angry white men are actually saying and what they're feeling, and I think it's fascinating. Number, once again, 503-231-8187, and we have a caller on the air. Hi.
Good morning, Teresa. Thank you for taking my call.
Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor. I am an angry white man, and I'd like to, I'd like to offer the perspective of a classical liberal. I advocate for the restoration of our federal system of government. And one of the main reasons, see, those of you on the progressive left have created your own reality. And that is one of the sources of our anger. Now, a lot of people who perceive themselves to be on the right do so because that's their only option. Our system of government was set up in a way where the federal system is an entity unto itself, which gave the people control of the means of production through their authority to tax and regulate industry at the local level. We view, at the classical liberal perspective, we view both modern left-right paradigm as to the left of that system.
Would you identify it? Are you saying that you are a classic liberal, or are you saying this is the position of classic liberal?
Yes, I am a classical liberal. I'm part of a classical liberal movement / liberty movement to restore the federal system.
Okay, and when you say you're an angry white man, what is it that you're most angry about?
Well, I view the current environment as that we are controlled by imperialists in much the same way Germany was controlled by imperialists under the Weimar Republic, and I see them creating scenarios where they're pitting us against each other so that they can get us into war and profit from it.
Dr. Kimmel, you have comments on that?
Your caller has an analysis that is actually, sort of amalgam of left and right. There's a kind, I don't know what exactly you mean when you say you want to restore the federal system. Is this sort of a reversion to no central government but state governments only and sort of the Jeffersonian small town? Is that the idea that you have in mind?
Yes, the federal system was an entity unto itself. The central government was limited to its enumerated powers in Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. The central government was not given control of the economy. The people had control of the economy through their authority to tax and regulate industry at the local level. That was to enable communities, diverse communities, to live amongst each other without there being conflict. Mm-hmm. The progressive left has done
multinational corporations and global banking as the leftists are, aren't you?
Well, I believe that the rise of international corporations and banking is due directly to the adopting of the progressive left policies, such as the central bank and the direct tax on the people.
I'm trying to get to the nitty gritty of what part of that system?
Here's what I would say. I mean, this is a place. This is a comment that reveals, to my mind, the fiction that we have a kind of linear continuum between the extreme left and the extreme right. Because there are people on the extreme left who would make the same argument that your caller is making, although they wouldn't go in the kind of libertarian direction, but they would go in an anarchist direction, which is libertarianism plus community. This sort of fundamental distrust of the government, of big government, of a federal government, I would be willing to bet that your caller is actually extremely patriotic and loves America, hates the government, loves the country, the idea of America.
No, I love my government. I love my federal government. My federal government has been marginalized. I am pro-government. Those who advocate for the modern status quo are anti-government. See, everything's been, we live under an Orwellian type of despotism, from my point of view.
Okay, so now that's what's causing your anger, right? The despotism. So you're angry, I'm guessing, because you have to send your kids off to war and you have to pay for war with your taxes? Is that where you're going with this?
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly.
Okay, well, thank you very much for that call.
Uh-huh.
And it's good to get that perspective out there. Number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. Talking about angry white men with author Michael Kimmel. You're listening to KBOO Portland. And we have another caller. Hi there.
Good morning.
Good morning,
Teresa. Thank you. Thank you very much for having a show. Great job. And Mr. Kimmel, thank you for coming on. I'm a black male. I work in a white male-oriented industry. I did not grow up in an activist background, so when I came into the world, my attitude about this world was a lot like Star Trek, because I missed what my parents and grandparents missed. And when I started dealing with this psychology, I found myself having to listen to white right-wing radio to understand the psychology of the people I were dealing with. And at an individual level, these guys are really good people. You know, it's like they're frustrated, and like the doctor said, they're losing their privilege and they're going through a type of temper tantrum. And it has, I think, something to do with the planet becoming smaller and we're becoming an international, you know, a global community, and how white males aren't a majority in the world. How is that going to translate into our government as far as us not repeating the same history that Weimar Germany did, for instance, and how this type of psychology can become prevalent? I mean,
so you're saying how to avoid reaction, then?
I had my own, I guess, stereotypes when it comes up to white males, and they were like, they were turned upside down when I really started like listening to Mike Savage and these guys, and I understood then their threatening, how they felt threatening. How are we going to handle this transition?
Dr. Kimmel, is about fear
for brown people and women and transgenders, and so far as understanding this, so that things don't get out of hand when it comes up to dealing with as I hear on right wing radio, white male, it's called white, they call it white male burden. I'll take this off the air and let you guys comment on it.
Thank you very much for your call.
All right.
Dr. Kimmel?
Well, you know, the mantra of a lot of the Tea Party or Rush Limbaugh and Mike Savage, if you remember, after the re-election of Barack Obama in 2012, the mantra that they all seem to say is, we have to take our country back. And the African-American op-ed columnist in the New York Times, Charles Blow, wrote a column about that. And he said, yes, you want to take your country back? Well, you can't have it. And here's the thing that I would want to tell your caller. I mean, first of all, I applaud your caller's willingness to do research, which is to say, to listen to views unlike his own, so that he could get an understanding of what's going on, what their psychology is. But here's the deal: we're not going to go backward. Women aren't going to wake up tomorrow morning and say to themselves, you know what, this thing about working and serving on juries and driving cars and having checkbooks in our own name, I mean, this is a drag. Let's stop. You know, let's go back. You know, it's not going to happen. The progress that LGBT people have made, the progress that black people have made, the progress that 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 women have made. These are not going to be undone. What you're listening to is the rage of a group of people who felt entitled to positions that they're not going to be getting. The question for me is not whether or not we're going to be able to turn this back. The question for me is, what are white men going to do with a world that is different than the world that we expected to inherit? And that question, we can be dragged kicking and screaming into the future, or we can say, well, okay, this is a done deal. What are we going to do about it? So to me, that's really, you know, so I see the angry white men as a kind of declining movement, not a rising movement. It's the last gasp of groups who are trying to deal with changes that have been so fast and so dramatic in their lifetimes that they're left kind of bewildered by it.
And there's, I guess it's about fear, isn't it? I mean, when I was saying that 17% of the Senate is women and half the population is women, so why are they fearful? But I guess the fear comes from the fact that there is change, and as you were saying, the change is rapid. Do you think that's the basis of it?
And you know what? I think that, you know, here's a place where most of our listeners, male and female, would definitely agree. And that is most Americans agree that the government shutdown was a complete disaster. It was a fiasco. It was a lot of grandstanding. It was totally unnecessary. Whether or not you even agree with, you know, repealing Obamacare, this was just ridiculous. Okay, so who stopped it? The women, the Republican women and the Democratic women reached across the aisle and said, hey, let's stop this thing, right? Where does it? So my feeling is, this is really a good thing, not only for the country, but a good thing for men like me sitting here thinking, this is ridiculous. We're losing billions of dollars a day. This is, you know, we're the laughingstock of the rest of the world. And I'm thinking, you know, it took the women in Congress to say, oh, this is enough. It's enough.
And so that is a good thing that that change has happened. Well, the number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187. 8187. The book is Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era. The author is Michael Kimmel, and you can talk directly to Michael Kimmel on the air on KBOO Portland right now, and that's what Rhonda's doing. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi there, Teresa. Thank you so much, and thanks, Dr. Kimmel, for this fascinating show. So I am in Portland as an advisor and also a facilitator for the Spiritual Alliance to Stop Intimate Violence, and that is a program that was founded by Dr. Rion Eisler and Nobel Peace Laureate Betty Williams in 2005, and we have a community partnership going here. So, you know, I think of Dr. Eisler's construct of dominator systems versus partnership systems. And the fact that those 17 women in the Senate, you know, certainly don't represent the 51% of women in the country. And she sees that as having just some real natural consequences, that we're going to have higher military spending, more wars, and has, you know, demonstrated this to be true in her comparisons of other political systems. When you get a better gender balance, then you get a shift in the way you're taking care of people and so on. And in fact, if people would go to our website at saiv.org, they'll be able to connect to some of her speeches. She gave one at the State Department in March called What's Good for Women is Good for the World. I'm particularly interested in one aspect of our national life where a system of entitlement for men is really entrenched. And I wonder if you're familiar with that. And that is in our court system in custody matters, where there's been a very strong, well-oiled and funded father's rights movement that has tried to, you've alluded to this, kind of tried to pretend that somehow women were being advantaged and that men are entitled, no matter what their background is criminally or their background of parenting, that they are entitled to contact with their children. Are you familiar with that?
Dr. Kimmel?
I one of the chapters of the book is actually about the father rights movement.
Fantastic. We need you.
So I am familiar with it, and have, you know, and have engaged with a lot of the father rights groups. And I'm also aware of the critique that you're offering and share it, but only in part. And the reason that I say that is because I think that what is happening with a lot of the father rights groups is two things. One, you described quite eloquently that men feel that they are completely entitled and that they should be able to get anything that they want, and that, you know, any prejudgment in favor of women, you know, is obviously, you know, discrimination against them and taking away what they feel entitled to. I share that. But there's another side to it as well. The truth is that large numbers of men, good-hearted, you know, regular guys, have actually begun to spend far more time with their children, far more time doing family life. They're doing somewhat more housework and a lot more child care. And when divorces, so they are what you might call, quote, new fathers, unquote, to some degree. When they go to court, the laws basically are written for Don Draper. They're written for the early to mid-1960s, when fathers did virtually nothing around the house and nothing with their children. And so they're feeling like they put in all of this effort and they're getting nothing back. Then they get angry and that entitlement sort of rears its head in very ugly ways. We agree about that entirely. But I do want to credit some of these men who do feel baffled and bewildered by the fact that they thought, good fathers, and now they're not getting any kind of recognition or acknowledgement of their being good fathers. Now, having said that, I want to be really clear that most people get the custody arrangements that they go into court asking for. For most of the cases, there's not this kind of conflict. We're only talking about 18% of all cases anyway. But I do think we have to credit some of these men's greater participation in family life prior to it. Now, their bewilderment, their kind of anguish, then gets manipulated by some of the father rights activists into this kind of blind anti-feminist rage, which we both know and we're, you know, quite aware of, and what that looks like.
Well, Michael Kimmel,
I appreciate you saying that, because there are the Rush Limbaughs of the father's rights movement who, in fact, will whip up anger. It's very lucrative for those in the business who get paid and whose salaries depend on there being constant conflict over custody. I also appreciate you mentioning that it's only 15% of cases that become, or 85% settle outside of court. And the 15% that end up in these high conflict custody cases are quite often women who are leaving abuse and an abuser who is angry because he's entitled to control he feels over his wife and his children, simply then moves the venue of his battering, if you will, into the court system, which is highly adversarial, a true dominator system, highly patriarchal.
Hear, hear.
Rigid, you know, reinforced by the threat of violence, which in this case is to remove the child from the mother if, you know, according to these standards where she may appear, quote, unreasonable. But if her unreasonableness comes from her unwillingness to entrust her child in unsupervised visits to a batterer or to somebody who's been sexually abusing the children, you know, her mama bear stance that is not reasonable is very understandable. So I think the data really, you know, is there, and I think we're going to be hearing more about this.
Thank you very much for your call.
Dr. Kimmel, having me.
You're welcome. Dr. Kimmel, one thing I keep hearing is the probably a small minority of men who are reacting to small change as if it were a loss of everything. Just everything's gone.
Right.
What's causing that? And what's causing that degree of fear?
I said earlier that a lot of this is fueled by the rapidity of this change and how dramatic it's been, so that the world seems virtually unrecognizable. And in that sense, I think, you know, that's what might fuel the kind of totalizing, everything has gone to hell kind of response, is because it does feel so overwhelming and so dramatic so fast.
The ground is slippery. You know, another thing that I keep thinking about in the context of this conversation isn't the construction of maleness in our society rather false? Isn't it brittle in the first place? And maybe these fears that everything is disappearing is because that construct has been cracked and must continue to crumble.
Yeah, well, I do agree. I agree that that where we are now, it's going to continue to be moving in the direction in which it has been moving. It's not going to be moving in any other direction. So the question really for men now is, how can we respond to this dramatic increase in gender, racial, sexual equality in a way that that doesn't feel like it's a colossal loss to us. And by the way, the data are pretty, I think, pretty persuasive that it's not a colossal loss for men. It's actually, you know, it's actually a pretty good thing.
Well, the number to call, 503-231-8187, 503-231-8187, and you're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. This is Political Perspectives, and we're talking with Michael Kimmel, author Dr. Michael Kimmel, about Angry White Men, American Masculinity, and the End of an Era, and I believe Elliot is on the air.
Yeah, based on the comments you made about your autobiography, I assume that the author was tenured in the 60s or the 70s when there were still academic jobs.
What autobiography is that?
I mean, what he said about himself on the program.
Huh.
Now, I just happened to be someone who got a multiple Ivy PhD in science in the late 80s when there were no jobs, so I became somewhat impoverished and uninsured. And I just feel that, you know, the problem with the left is we cannot form any kind of coalition for economic change in an increasingly fascistic and corrupt and distorted system, because 90% of the effort is pushed into blowing trumpets about 100 other cultural issues, and
you don't feel like you could just take your place along with everyone else with you know, improving conditions.
How is that going to happen when even in alternative radio stations, you know, there's a lot of cronyism? You can have I'm not in healthcare. You can have 1,000 qualified people in healthcare, and there'll be cronyism that new people who have a different perspective in healthcare will not be allowed on the air because there's a lot of cronyism. And so I'm sure he's right that a lot of these you know, outraged, super right-wing, right males are motivated by the brittleness of their economic situation. But the left isn't really interested in forming a coalition around that. I mean, you know, if the left had a greater focus on the deteriorating economics and the total collapse of the labor movement and the total collapse of job ladders, such as the transformation of most academics into semi-impoverished adjuncts, then maybe we'd get somewhere. But 80% of the energy goes into saying that, you know, that the cultural minorities need 10 times more rights than they already have.
How much, just to try to set the horizon here, would you say that cultural minorities are getting too much attention altogether then? Should it go back to white males?
No, I would say that in areas of the country where you know, for various historical reasons, unsavory historical reasons in some cases, if there was somewhat more flexibility in how much you push the issues other than trying to rebuild economic equity and reduce dollarocracy, as it's recently been called, political fascist corporate corruption, then, you know, maybe, you know, we'd make a little more progress. But
okay, well, thank you very much for your opinion. Number to call, 503-231-8187. Your comments, Dr. Michael Kimmel?
Can I respond to that a little bit?
Absolutely.
For a moment, if you don't mind?
Please.
Well, it seems to me, first of all, I do want to reassure your caller. I was actually tenured in 1991, so I'm just at the cusp of the transformation of the university from this genteel place where tweedy white men got tenure and had nice jobs in secure positions forever.
Did you say tweedy?
To a position of madness you know, 60 or 70% of all courses being taught by adjuncts and much far less job security, et cetera. So I'm right on the cusp. Now, here's the thing. The argument that you just heard, I think, is really, really important for us to listen to, Teresa, because it could go either way. If I were to say to you, yes, those women and people of color, because of affirmative action, now every department has to bend over backwards to make sure they're diverse, make sure they're multicultural, and poor and guys like you don't get those kinds of secure jobs anymore. You could go to the right and become an angry white man. Or you could say the real problem with universities is the invasion of market criteria in an institution that had been shielded from the marketplace for so long, so that now, because of the collapse at my university or every other state university, the collapse of state funding. When I came to Stony Brook, where I teach, about 70% of our budget was paid for by the state of New York. Today it's less than 20% of our budget is paid for by the state of New York. We have to generate our own money. We have to generate grants. We have to, you know, there's a constant frenzy for money on college campuses. So what that means is we have to cut costs. Well, what are the only costs of a college campus? You don't produce anything, so you got to cut labor costs. So, of course, that's what we do. I mean, and so my feeling is you can go to the left and blame the marketization, the proliferation of market-based criteria in every institution in America, or you can go to the right and say it's the fact that our jobs are being given to women and black people. You see what I mean? That's what the anguish you just heard in this call, exactly the anguish that I have experienced myself and I've experienced from the men that I talk to. Uh-huh. And it is movable to either political position.
All right. Well, and, you know, there's so much more. I could talk another hour about your book, but, of course, we're coming up to the top of the hour, so it's summarizing time. And I've heard over and over again this idea that, you know, things are just, well, okay, you said it right at the start. What do you mean our? You know, taking back our country, why is it white men's country in the first place, and why is that an unassailable idea? I mean, it seems to me that getting around this would be challenging the idea that it's a white men's country in the first place, or that it should be.
I think that I agree with the argument that I agree with the quote that Barack Obama used when he himself quoted Martin Luther King, saying that the arc of history always points to toward greater justice. Greater equality. It's a long and slow process, and it's very discomforting for some of those who have benefited from a system of inequality. We've had that system of inequality for such a long time, we actually think it was a level playing field. It is truly odd to hear white men now argue against a system of meritocracy that would actually include everyone.
Okay, I think that summarizes it very nicely. Well, Michael Kimmel, thank you very much for coming on. The book is Angry White Men, American Masculinity at the End of an Era, and it is published by Perseus Groups, nationbooks.org. You can find it, and of course you can find it locally here at the Union Bookstore, Powell's Books, and we have other bookstores as well because Portland's kind of known for that.
You are. Lucky you.
Yeah, I know. Michael Kimmel, thank you very much for coming on.
Take care.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Stay tuned for more of the incomparable radio zine.
Tune into the Recovery Zone 11 to noon this Wednesday to find out how our food choices may be affecting the environment, our health, and our relationships with one another.
If we really are serious about wanting to have peace on this planet, we have to look at the ramifications of our food choices. We're not some kind of species that is fundamentally flawed. We're always going to have domination and war and so forth. We're born into a culture essentially with an obsolete food orientation. The beauty of the message is that we absolutely can transform our culture.
Learn more from Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet, on The Recovery Zone on KBOO Portland, this Wednesday, November 27th from 11 to noon. Your turkey day could well never be the same.
And you are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Merrillhurst University's five part-time MBA programs designed for adults who are seeking to enhance skills, revitalize career potential, and gain new knowledge that can be applied at work the next day. December 5th, evening information session, details at merrillhurst.edu. Stay tuned now for Flashpoints, 11 o'clock, the Recovery Zone. Oh, one last minute breaking announcement. Teresa will be back to host a special show tomorrow at 8 a.m. That sounds like a talk radio segment. Tune in tomorrow at 8 a.m. for that. Thanks for listening.
On Flashpoints, is the U.S. backpedaling on the recent Iran nuclear agreement? Also, in Santa Rosa, California, young Latinos take to the streets again to protest the recent killing of 13-year-old Andy Lopez by a seasoned sheriff's deputy. And immigrants' rights activists protest ongoing massive deportations. The American Indian movement battles to decolonize the Washington Redskins. That battle continues in San Francisco and around the country. I'm Dennis Burke.